this week, my daughter actually stayed home from school one day because she wasn't feeling very well. And we spent time working in her math workbook. Now, before you think I'm a terrible mother, this was at her request. I don't make my children do math problems when they're homesick. She was very excited to dig into this math workbook that we had bought from a school book fair. And she ended up working on two very different mathematical concepts that actually had really huge lessons for me this week as I was reflecting on the gospel text. They are the Dijkstra algorithm and the Fibonacci sequence. I feel like really fancy just saying them out loud, I have to admit. But don't fret or be intimidated. It took a child's math book to remind me that one of them even existed and to teach me for the first time about another. So if this is all sounding Greek to you, you are not alone. So let me see if I can summarize what these two concepts are and whether you thought you would get a math lesson at church today or not. I don't know, but here we are. So the Dijkstra algorithm is the first one. And it is an algorithm, which is a process for solving a math problem, right? So it is a process that is used to find the shortest path between two points. For example, all of those handy-dandy GPS devices that we have are programmed with this algorithm, the Dijkstra algorithm, and they help us find our way, right? The map has what we call plot points or nodes. So for example, your house might be a node, and then the corner of your street might be another node, and then the corner around the corner might be another node, and the lines between those two nodes are called edges. And the algorithm adds up, there may be more than one path to get from point A to point G, right? So the algorithm will add those edge lines up, and the shortest route is the one to take, right? So you could go this way or you could go that way, but when you add the edge lines, one might add up to 10 and one might add up to 12. And so the map will tell you to take the one with 10, right? It'll help you find the shortest way to get to the place you want to go. Oddly enough, this got me thinking about how we interact with the way, the one Jesus teaches about and embodies. I know that just as our computers have been programmed to spit out the fastest path for us, I too have been programmed, in a sense, trained perhaps by our culture, of trying to ever expand production and consumption. I have been shaped by that hunger for efficiency to always seek out the fastest path. Not only when I drive somewhere, but when I'm cooking in the kitchen, or when I'm sewing something, or even when I'm working with a group to move toward a decision, I find the urge to seek out the fastest path to get there. And I realize I'm already a pro, actually, at the Dijkstra algorithm. I just didn't know what it was called. The gospel story from Mark today invites us into reflecting about what happens on the way. Jesus is literally on the way. He's on the road out of Jericho, taking the road to Jerusalem. And there's a healing that is performed in motion on the way. He's also, in the midst of physically being on the way in this story, teaching about the way. He's just had a series of teachings about what it means to embody the way. He is himself embodying the way as he offers a healing on this road. And in this sequence as well, he's in a conversation with the disciples about the way. The particular sequence of the story we read today goes like this. Bartimaeus, the man who cannot see, cries out, "I want to see." He's on the road, out of the city, on the way to the big city. It was a place where folks would often have been lined with people who had very little resource, who would ask for support from those who had resource, living in the small city and the large city. He was sitting on the side of the road, begging to ensure his own survival, and it was the crowd that first rebukes Bartimaeus and tries to quiet his voice. He cries louder, and Jesus tells the crowd to call him over. The crowd calls him over, and Bartimaeus casts his cloak on the road, which is a gesture of begging, right? If I cast my cloak or my garment for you to walk upon, you will offer me alms in return. But instead of offering him pennies, Jesus restores his sight and heals him. He says, "Go, your faith has made you well." Now, before I go a little further into this story, I just want to pause and say a word about disability justice as we read this text. We often assume that every person who is blind or deaf or paralyzed in the Bible wanted to be healed of that particular disability, which reveals our own assumption about most people who are blind or deaf or paralyzed today. It is actually not true that every blind person would first ask to regain sight if asked by Jesus. For some, blindness is a part of who they are, and there may be another place in their body or their life that they need healing more. As it so happens, Jesus asked Bartimaeus, "What is it that you want me to do for you?" And this person with blindness did say, "Please, let me regain my sight." It is worth noticing that Jesus asked what healing this man wanted. Now, back to where this story lands in the larger narrative. Mark often holds stories in pairs beside each other to illumine things or to critique things. And when we read a story in isolation, we can miss that context or the larger critique that's happening in the arc of the storytelling. So this healing narrative about Bartimaeus is actually linked in a chain with a few episodes. It's connected to, one, the story you read just a few weeks ago about the rich young ruler who was invited into discipleship and could not give up or offer what was needed to follow on the way. It's also linked to the scene where the disciples fail to understand. They fail to see the dangerous implications of following Jesus on the way. Right after Jesus has predicted his death in detail, James and John ask to sit at the right and the left of Jesus when he comes into glory. And Jesus says to them, "You do not know, you do not see what you are asking for." Jesus was building a political campaign against Rome, and time again, he was critiquing the occupying force. They were heading into Jerusalem, the heart of that occupied territory for their community. And I'm not sure exactly what James and John were hoping for, but perhaps they thought that when Jesus came to power, when Jesus overthrew this imperial force, they could be granted positions of authority at his right and at his left. Cabinet members, you might say, right? What Jesus says to them is that they have not yet understood the way, that to sit at the right and the left is not what they think. The way is about overturning imperial force, in this instance, Roman occupation, through nonviolence. And Jesus was clear that the way was not merely another political campaign that was grounded in military force or a coup. These attempts were happening in his time, and Jesus was different than those attempts. And that the consequences of living the way would likely be life-threatening risks associated with embodying this nonviolent way of pursuing peace and justice and liberation from occupation. The disciples have caught the vision of a world turned upside down, right? They feel and see and know the cost of oppression. They were the fishermen, right? Marginalized folks. But they've not really realized what they need to do or how they need to change to make it come into reality. They haven't recognized that the way Jesus is inviting them into required their own turning away from a culture of dominance and a culture of violence in order to rise to power. So the contrast then is pretty stark. When we put the story of the rich young ruler and the misunderstanding of James and John next to the story of Bartimaeus, right? These happen in a chain in Mark. In this story, Bartimaeus is on the way and is clear about his own need for healing. He pursues it, and he comes along as a follower on the way with new vision. Jesus is teaching and demonstrating and embodying time and again that in order to find collective healing from systems of oppression, in order to be liberated by the occupying force of empire, we must seek the way of peace, the way of healing. We must turn away from cultures of violence in our pursuit of the kingdom of God. And that will require all of us to change and to be healed. By putting the story of the disciples' misunderstanding next to the story about blindness, Mark actually does this more than once in the gospel, he reminds the readers that those who yet pursue the way, even today, that it is easy for even Jesus' closest disciples to not yet fully see what is required of them. One of the podcasts I listen to regularly is called Finding Our Way. And the description for this ongoing conversation, which is curated by Prentice Hemphill, the host, goes like this. This is the description of the podcast and the conversation they are hosting. Finding Our Way is about how we realize the world we want. Finding Our Way is about how we realize the world we want, the dream, the vision of the world we want, the kingdom of God, the beloved community, by pursuing our own healing and transformation. Finding our way toward that vision happens by pursuing our own healing and transformation, our being individual and collective. Healing both illumines the path forward for us, and the way beckons our healing. We cannot realize this vision of the beloved community without healing, you and me. Okay, so this is where the Fibonacci sequence comes in. Are you ready? The Fibonacci sequence is simply a sequence of numbers. Okay, and the rule that guides the sequence is that each next number in the sequence is the sum of the previous two. So if you start with 0 and 1, what do you get when you add those two up? 1, yes. Should have been a math teacher. 1 plus 1 is 2. 1 plus 2 is 3. 2 plus 3 is 5. See how they're getting bigger? 3 plus 5 is 8. I've run out of fingers. I can't do it anymore. So as you add these numbers, this exponential growth happens, right? And when you plot it out on a map, it actually looks like this spiral. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger. The amazing thing about this sequence, I think, is that it shows up all over the natural world. Even in trees. Some of you may have heard this before, and it was just a reminder to me, and I'm really excited about it. A tree starts with one trunk, and then it goes to 2, and then it goes to 3, and it eventually goes, I gotta look at my notes, to 8, 13, 21, 34, 55, to get the canopy of the tree. They follow the Fibonacci sequence. It's also how the spirals of the aloe plants and the pine cones and the sunflower seeds and the snail shells and the ram's horns are shaped, are by that sequence. Even hurricanes and spiral galaxies in space have this sequence. If we apply the Fibonacci sequence to the story of healing in this way, we begin to understand the impact of just one person's healing. As one person heals and another person heals, and you add them together, these collective healings begin to grow and amplify into our collective healing. Each healing episode builds a bigger movement and a greater connection between those who have been harmed and oppressed. Each time one person experiences or demands, like Bartimaeus, their own healing, we add to the chorus of those who are using their voice to say no. We exponentially grow our capacity to say no to cultures and structures that are dehumanizing and death-dealing. Finding our way through that collective pain requires individuals to heal. As writer Adrienne Marie Brown says, small is all. How we are at the small scale is how we are at the large scale. Just as the sunflower seeds are shaped that way, so is the spiral galaxy. And so, there is no racial justice without my and your healing from a culture of dominance. There is no climate justice without my and your healing from a culture obsessed with extraction and overconsumption. There is no class justice without my and your healing from a culture preoccupied with property and profit. We can say no and demand dignity and belonging and safety for ourselves and one another at the same time. I believe we can. This requires those who benefit from systems of oppression to actually stop asking what privilege they have to give up to right the system, and start asking, how are these systems hurting me too? How are these systems hurting me too? And then begin to heal from that place. As the civil rights leader Ruby Sales says, she doesn't even like to call it privilege when talking about those who are on one side of a social oppression or another. Because why would anyone, she says, call it a privilege when our gain is won on the backs and at the expense of other humans' lives or the planet's? Why is that privilege? Instead, we must discern, how are these systems of oppression also hurting us? And can we begin to heal in that place? I find it comforting to recognize how small some of the work is when we think about what it means to heal from massive systems of oppression like white supremacy or climate catastrophe. Collective healing from these systems and realities often means unlearning. Unlearning cultures of dominance, unlearning cultures of consumption and extraction, unlearning the culture of private ownership so that we can lean into a culture of interdependence, lean into cultures of satisfaction and contentment, lean into a culture of collective ownership. I shared about my math lessons this week, but there's actually one small fractal of healing that happened on that day too. My daughter was actually not all that sick. She had a very small amount of congestion, and she felt tired. And I knew that. I knew that, you know, it was, she's seven, right? They begin to play with, like, what authority they have. We knew she didn't have COVID. Pandemic adds another layer. I just want to acknowledge that. We knew she didn't have COVID. And on a normal day, I would have said to myself, I really need time to work. And so I said, would have said to her, you'll be fine, and send her on her way to school, right? But as I recognized that impulse in me, I felt deeply the impulse toward finding the fastest way. The impulse toward feeling pinched for time in my work and not being able to produce what I needed to produce. My body was searching for the way that would be the most efficient. I started calculating how other adults in my house could help support so that I could still squeeze things in. And all of that would have required her and me to push through the tired, to push through the sniffles, and to push through the true need for rest. When she asked me that morning, as soon as she woke up, I processed these impulses in my head, and I said to her, sure, you can stay home. And as soon as I said it, after toiling over what I would have to do for my work and my calendar and how it was going to mess up my week, and, you know, all that happens in an instant in our brains, right? As soon as I said it out loud to her, sure, you can stay home, there was this opening in myself. I felt a satisfaction that I would have a little extra special time with my daughter. It turns out we had some fun with math. And I felt this expansion in myself about what was possible, about what happens when we give each other the space we need to rest and heal in a world that most often doesn't give us that space. And I felt a sense of pride and contentment about the lesson she was receiving, about asking for what she needs, and what it feels like to receive the support that you need. Our bodies are not here to produce and extract, and nor are they machines that execute perfect work or never tire. Our bodies are here to experience the beauty and the pleasure and the joy of God's creation, and to testify to the goodness of life. When we have been separated from that purpose, we are in need of healing and of finding our way back home. This small choice was a step of healing on the way for me to unwind and untangle myself from a culture of extraction, right? A fast pace, move, 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 produce, produce, produce. The next night, I shared that choice that I made with others in a group that I'm in, and they too actually ended up sharing their fractals of healing in the past few weeks. Each one additional fractal of healing, practices that were demanding each of our own worthiness, affirming our purpose as beloved people, and beginning to wash away those cultures of oppression that have sought to dehumanize us. And as we shared in this container, our healing grew from 0 to 1 to 3 to 5 to 8 to 13, expanding and breathing outward into the world. As we carry the gift of our own stories, our one story, our one fractal, healing becomes amplified. And the powers and the principalities of a world that is structured around dominance and greed begin to crumble. So as I close, I want to situate all of that in the season we are in. We are in a season of falling away, of laying down, a season of grief and acknowledging those who have died, a season of slowing down. We know that this happens in the natural world, right? But even as the sunflower bends her head to the earth, like one in prayer, they have been fascinating me this week. Even as that sunflower dies, she drops her seed for the next life to emerge. I invite you to consider what you might be laying down in this season. What parts of these cultures of oppression are hurting you? And in that laying down, what healing, what seed is being planted? What small fractal of healing is moving in you? And where and how might you share your story of healing so that it might be celebrated and amplified as we hold one another in this collective work? I too am in this work, let me be clear. I too am learning how to untangle and heal from these systems and cultures that dehumanize us all. And I am grateful to be in this healing work with you. Amen.